Funerals were a prime source of extra income. Many ministers received as funeral favors a white scarf to be worn folded over the right shoulder. A wife who was a handy seamstress found many ways to use these scarves. When Sarah Van Brugge died in 1742 in New York, her family economized by giving out linen rather than silk scarves, yet they still had a bill of £500 for funeral favors. A popular minister also was given many gloves at funerals. Andrew Elliott of Old North Church in Boston left such a collection of kidskin and lamb's wool gloves that when they were bartered in 1742, they brought the equivalent of $640. Other ministers received mourning rings, small gold bands similar to wedding rings. Dr. Sam Buxton of Salem left a tankard of them when he died in 1758. Perhaps the champion at acquiring a fringe benefits was Anthony Stoddard. For 60 years minister in Woodbury, Connecticut, he was also clerk of the probate clerk and town doctor. The town gave him a fine house and a maximum land allotment, and the house was his own. He left an estate of £1,000 in 1760. Many towns gave a minister a chance to enhance his salary by tutoring boys for college or by doing bleedings. But Edwards was not a man with a talent for fawning on people who might reward him with gifts or perquisites. An argument about ministers' salaries had been building up in many towns. In 1706, an anonymous friend to the churches published a plea for the ministers of the gospel. The gist of it was that the clergy's prestige would decline unless they were paid at least as much as merchants or tradesmen. In 1725, another anonymous pamphlet, Anti-Ministerial Objections Considered, claimed that many towns thought a chief minister is the best. It argued that if clergy were still to lead the community, they must be more than middling livers. This debate came at a sensitive time when the American economy was unstable. No settled form of currency had been worked out for the colonies, and barter was a common form of commerce. Part of the trouble came from honest misunderstanding about the nature of work. Few people comprehended that a man may be working very hard when he is thinking. On the frontier, most men worked prodigiously with their muscles. Plows were heavy, and so were the blacksmith's hammers and the axes that whacked down masts for ships. Pounding flax in the hot days of late June was a back-breaking chore. Parishioners with aching muscles and calloused hands resented a soft-handed clergyman whose tool was a pen. The scorn of the busy layman for the sedentary parson was expressed in 1753 by lawyer William Livingston, who described a little airy coxcomb, too lazy to work and too proud to beg, who jumps into commission with a lie in his mouth that he is moved by the Holy Ghost when his highest aim is a fat living. It had been different in Stoddard's time. In the early years of the colonies, the leadership of a learned clergy was vital. Moreover, Stoddard had independent wealth. His many children had diminished the estate, however, and none of it was coming to Edwards. No one whispered when Stoddard ate from fine china, though other people had wooden bowls. He had the only gold watch in town and was the first to drink tea. Even Judge Sewell, who had been niggardly about his local clergyman, freely heaped gifts on Stoddard. He always sent back for Madame Stoddard a piece of commencement cake, or 2-pound sacks of raisins and almonds, or large chunks of chocolate when her husband came to Harvard functions. But Stoddard was a different sort of man, and that had been a very different era. His place had never been questioned. When Edwards came to the church, he received 10 acres of pasture, 40 acres of meadow, and 10 additional acres on a hill, as well as £300 toward his house and £100 a year as salary. This was a handsome amount for a country preacher then. In 1731, after babies began to appear, he was given £40 more. Then £100 was added the next year. Each increase jangled nerves in the town. There was more to the situation. A mood that was to produce the revolution was also showing in revolt against such autocratic clergy as the notorious man who said, "I do not serve my parish, I rule it." One way parishes expressed their displeasure in a preacher was to forget to stock his wood supply. One chilly November Sunday, the Reverend Mr. French of Andover, Massachusetts, wryly announced, "I will write 2 discourses and deliver them in this meeting house on Thanksgiving Day, provided I can manage to write them without a fire." The Boston Newsletter of November 18, 1728, printed a sample budget for 8 persons in families of middling figure who bear the character of being genteel. It allowed for beer, for soap, for baths once in 4 weeks, for 3 candles a night, for a maid at £10 a year, and 3 pairs of shoes each year. The Edwardses fitted this bracket, yet the sample budget made no provision for the entertaining Sarah did incessantly, for charitable gifts, for letter writing, or for schooling. All of these were necessities of life for the Edwardses. Sharp eyes scrutinized the clothes Sarah and the girls wore to church. In the valley, there was a long tradition of regarding fancy clothes with suspicion. People who had less than £200 in property were prohibited by law from wearing silver or gold buttons. Ladies were frowned on for appearing in public with a knot of ribbon at the shoulder. A Northampton court had tried Hannah Lyman, aged 16, for wearing silk in a flaunting manner. So the town watched for signs of extravagance in the ladies of the Edwards household. They also whispered about the fact that Edwards himself had his suits tailored in Boston. Dr. Mather, at Edwards's request, was put on a committee to discuss salary with him. Mather tried to be reconciling, but the other members of the committee rammed through a humiliating ruling that Sarah had to keep an itemized statement of parsonage expenses. Later, Sarah recalled, "I remember Mr. Edwards once said the difficulties he had a prospect of appeared to him like a bottomless ocean. He could see no end of them. I once asked him whether it was worth his while to strive to have his salary settled, seeing he thought it probable this difficulty would end in a separation between him and his people. He answered, there were so great difficulties arose through the salary being unsettled that though he tarried but a year or two, he chose to have it done." One other event stood out in the year 1741. In June, Edwards had preached in his own church, with no effect, a sermon entitled "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." His own parishioners had listened lethargically and then, unscathed by the sermon, had strolled outdoors to talk about whether the sunshine would hold up for the haying season. But on July 8, Edwards attended a conference in Enfield, Connecticut, and was asked on short notice to preach there. He dipped into his saddlebag and hauled out the sermon he had preached to his own congregation without causing a ripple of reaction. In the plain little country church of Enfield, he made homiletic history. People yelled and shrieked. They rolled in the aisles. They crowded up into the pulpit and begged him to stop. One observer reported, one waited with the deepest and most solemn solicitude to hear the trumpet sound, and was deeply disappointed when the day terminated and left the world in its usual state of tranquility. Henry Ward Beecher later commented, I think a person of moral sensibilities alone at midnight reading that awful discourse would well nigh go crazy. The people in Enfield that Sunday were in an expectant mood to hear the visiting preacher, who was said to be famous even across the Atlantic Ocean. They did not take him for granted, as Edwards' home church did. They did not hear him all the time, so they listened with fresh sensibilities. What he said slashed through to the hearers as a sermon seldom has in all of history. The second phase of the awakening crested in the spring and summer of 1741. Edwards believed that it had produced a remarkable and general alteration in the face of New England. At least 10% of New England's population claimed to be converted. Instead of exulting in these statistics, Edwards was saddened by a mood he sensed. He who cherished orderly continuity in society saw the revival movement splintering churches now. He who tried to be rational saw the religious experience grotesquely distorted by emotionalism. Two men were most responsible for the new mood. One was James Davenport, a revivalist who was, in fact, teetering on the edge of sanity. He had been storming into Connecticut parsonages, quizzing the preacher, then leaving with the verdict that the minister was not a man of God. Later, Davenport wrote a moving public apology. I had the long fever on me and the cankery humor raging at once, though I thought in the time of it that 'twas the Spirit of God in high degree. He went back to call on one minister he had insulted, and the man said he came with such a meek, mild, pleasant, and humble spirit, broken and contrite, as I scarce ever saw. Davenport ended by settling down as a respectable Presbyterian clergyman in New Jersey. The other disturber of the peace was Gilbert Tennant, minister of the Presbyterian Church in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Tennant had introduced there a method of close personal preaching coupled with intensive and searching counseling. In 1735, coinciding with the revival in Northampton, Tennant published four of his innovative sermons and an account of his methods of conversion. Some of his colleagues in the Synod of New Jersey parted from his contention that the power of the minister's labors came not from his personal holiness, but from God's call to him. This led to a rift in 1741 over whether vacant pulpits should be filled by men approved by the official church governing body or by preachers who simply announced that they were appointed by God. The schism lasted 17 years and eventually was healed by Tennant's own growth in magnanimity. He later apologized for the excessive heat of temper he had shown. It was in part the result of his grief over the death of his wife. He described it as a time of great spiritual desertion. In 1758, Tennant presided over the reuniting meeting, which brought back together the splintered synod. But in 1742, he was a problem for Edwards. He was going about New England, conducting revival meetings almost as hectic as those of Davenport. The spectacle prompted one friend of Edwards to write to Bellamy. "There are some things that persons are apt to run into at the present day that we ought not to encourage, taking their own passions and imaginations for the operations of God's Spirit, giving heed to visions, trances, and revelations." These were Edwards' own reservations about the methods of Gilbert Tennant and James Davenport. Against this backdrop, Edwards was given a hard assignment. He was asked to be speaker at the Yale commencement in September 1741. Of all those who disapproved of emotionalism, one of the most hostile critics was Thomas Clapp, Yale's president. Everyone waited to hear whether Edwards would repudiate the excesses that had been carried on in the name of religion. Everyone watched the face of President Clapp as he listened to the speaker. Edwards tried to use this opportunity to bring the awakening under rational control again. His sermon was called "The Distinguishing Marks of a Work of the Spirit of God," and in its clean, carefully crafted sentences, it analyzed the revival, concluding that it was, in general, from the Spirit of God. Davenport and Tennant were delighted by this, though Edwards had said, "They who leave the sure word of prophecy to follow such impressions and impulses leave the polar star to follow a jack with a lantern." The Yale commencement was a carnival that night, with all the windows on New Haven green lighted by candles. There were fireworks and many flowing punch bowls. At Harvard during that period, commencements were toasted so enthusiastically that one jingle said, "Thus the loose crowd forbidden pleasures seek, drink Harvard dry, and so conclude the week." But President Clapp made it clear that he was not in a festive mood, and the evening was dismal for Edwards. Then he journeyed home to face a crisis in the life of his wife. Chapter 8, To the Breaking Point and Back. To see in the eternal feminine's ideal of passivity and self-containment the seeds of self-paralysis and self-alienation is the great task of the modern era, resembling that task already recognized to establish, through love, the authentic self of the infant. Dan Sullivan. We wish we could erase the whole month of January 1742, but because this episode in the life of Sarah Edwards was so peculiar, so unlike the character she showed in all the rest of her years, it is inescapable. Here we don't like her at all. The serene mother becomes limply needful. The patient wife comes to the end of her patience. The attractive hostess becomes grotesque, jabbering, hallucinating, idiotically fainting. We are embarrassed for her. But isn't this what each of us does in our bad dreams? What sometimes we refrain from doing by the thinnest edge of self-control? What we finally do when we have a nervous breakdown? Here Sarah stands exposed as a fully human woman, one with a breaking point, as any woman has. Before, she had been too good to be true. But, and here is mystery, this blackness was over soon, and she never went through such an episode again. We would prefer to dodge this awkward spot, but it is the heart of her story. Such a period of anguish seems to be often the necessary step before a person fully feels the transforming power of God. This was Jacob's night of wrestling with the angel. Benedict's role in the rose bush, the mythic struggle. Neither is there any explanation for the peace that comes on the far side of such confusion. Jacob was blessed by the angel as dawn broke. Benedict went on to preserve the life of the intellect through the dark ages. Sarah went back to her routine, more efficient than before. But for 1 month in 1742, as snow sparkled on the Hampshire hills, Sarah Edwards went to pieces. For the first 14 years of the marriage of Sarah and Jonathan Edwards, she seemed to the outside world to be the sunny and stable member of the team. While Edwards pampered his headaches and his finicky colon, she would scarcely pause when she shucked off a baby, Hopkins reports of her. She was unmindful of any pain or affliction. As he was of a weakly, infirm constitution, she was a tender nurse to him, cheerfully attending upon him at all times, and in all things ministering to his comfort. The wife expected to be Spartan in those days, one woman wrote in her diary, took physic and consulted the physician, all to no purpose, suspected the disorder to be nervous, faced about, put on great resolution, and made mince pies and found myself no worse than before. The casual observer saw the difficult husband, the endlessly giving wife. Actually, more than anyone on the outside guessed, she leaned on him. Though she carried all the practical details of managing the house, Sarah depended on Edwards for her own spiritual replenishment. She would dart into his study during the day, confident that no matter how intent he was on his writing, he would put down his pen and turn to her with lighted face. She fed on his leadership of family prayers and on the quiet time she and Edwards spent together on devotions after the children were in bed, the time that put a benediction on all the bustle of the daylight hours. When Edwards was away, she had to carry all the complex administration of a large household without nourishment for her own inner self, without someone she could allow to share her fears and failings. She could take anything but his absences. Edwards knew this, and he worried about the mounting calls upon him to travel. He confided to Bellamy on January 21, 1742, "I desire your prayers that God would quicken and revive us again, and particularly that he would greatly humble and pardon and quicken me." He went on to turn down an invitation to speak in Connecticut with this explanation: "I have lately been so much gone from my people and don't know, but I must be obliged to leave them again next week for a fortnight, being called to Leicester, a town about halfway to Boston, and probably soon after that to another place, and having at this time some extraordinary affairs to attend to at home." These were the extraordinary affairs he mentioned. On January 19, as Sarah described herself, "I felt very uneasy and unhappy. I thought I very much needed help from God. I had for some time been earnestly wrestling with God. I felt within myself great quietness of spirit, unusual willingness to wait upon him with respect to the time and manner in which he should help me, and wished that he should take his own time and his own way to do it." In spite of this protestation about her patience with God, her nerves were actually stretched like an overtuned viola, so that she was crushed when, the next morning, Edwards mildly pointed out to her that she might have been tactless in a conversation she had had the previous day with Mr. Williams of Hadley. This was probably the same relative who had been huffy since the first days of the awakening and had since snubbed every ironic gesture from the Edwardses. This deteriorated relationship had increasingly bothered Sarah when Edwards suggested that she might have handled Williams more adroitly. She crumbled. I found that it seemed to bereave me of the quietness and calm of my mind in any respect not to have the good opinion of my husband. This I much disliked in myself. She goes on to explain, the peace and calm of my mind seemed sensibly above the reach of disturbance from anything but these two. First, my own good name and fair reputation among men, and especially the esteem and just treatment of the people of this town. Secondly, and more especially, the esteem and love and kind treatment of my husband. So Edwards, in his casual remark about her handling of the difficult Mr. Williams, punctured Sarah's two most vulnerable points, her anxiety about offending people and her need to be approved by her husband. Edwards had not been able to extricate himself from the date in Leicester, so he took off the next day, and her first anxiety swept over Sarah. It is curious that a minister's wife feels she has to be popular in a parish. If a man does his work as well as he is able, his own conscience should provide a measure of his success. Yet almost all ministers' wives appear to need assurance that they, too, are accepted warmly by the people. This illogical human need was now nibbling at Sarah Edwards. A young man named Buell had come to fill the pulpit while Edwards was absent. Sarah says of him, I heard that Mr. Buell was coming to this town, and from what I had heard of him and of his success, I had strong hopes that there would be great effects from his labors here. At the same time, it greatly concerned me to watch my heart and see to it that I was perfectly resigned to God with respect to the instruments he should make use of to revive religion in this town, and be entirely willing, if it was God's pleasure, that he should make use of Mr. Buell. This being translated may have meant that she was afraid the people might like Mr. Buell better than they liked her husband, and that she disliked herself for feeling that way. Often an older minister has plugged in and then had an attractive assistant whiz in, full of youthful energy and ambition. The older man may rejoice that his young associate can reach certain people who had not been touched before, but only a rare minister is not threatened. After the muted Edwards, the people of the congregation enjoyed the masculine vitality of young Buell. Edwards, on his part, had no competitiveness in his makeup. He was simply delighted by anyone of ability who could add to the work of the kingdom. However, Edwards had always been impervious to social nuances. Sarah, whose genius was her ability to tune in on the feelings of other people, was, on the other hand, exceptionally vulnerable to hostility. The threat of Buell almost undid her before she was freed of jealousy forever. President Claff at Yale had disapproved of Buell because he had appointed himself evangelist and gone riding around Connecticut in a revival team with Eleazar Wheelock, afterward founder of Dartmouth College. Buell later admitted that he had been guilty of some imprudence and indecent heats. He said this before the Fairfield Association of Clergy when he was asking them to ordain him. The older clergy thought Buell needed some tempering before he could qualify for ordination, so they sent him to study under Edwards. He promptly captivated the congregation, and Sarah was confronted by the need to take into her household a guest who was more popular than her husband was. A wife who is sensitive to social opinions feels them most sharply during a minister's absence from the parish. As a single tree on a hillside is likely to draw lightning, so the minister in a Puritan community was a lone oak, a large target for speculation, gossip, and misinterpretation. When Edwards was around, he absorbed these pressures, partly because of his God-centered serenity, and partly because he was so absent-minded that he did not pick up the vibrations in the community. When he was away, Sarah picked them up alone. She saw a stout old lady, whom Edwards never coddled, purring as she told Mr. Buell about herself. And why had that knot of people lowered their voices as Sarah walked toward the church porch? Old Mrs. Hawley, teacup and knitting in her bag, was turning up a neighbor's path for an afternoon chat. What would they talk about? With Edwards away, Sarah had no one to absorb her fears. When she could take them to her husband, he helped her see the smallness of the world of Northampton in perspective against the vast sweep of the starry skies, against the infinite mysteries of the atom, and against the other cities and countries where the Edwards name was becoming known with increasing respect. He cared about the little world of their parish, but he saw it in relation to the rest of God's world. Without Edwards near to steady her, Sarah cracked. The beady eye of the modern psychiatrist might spot the phase she entered as a manic one. She thought she was passing through a period of religious ecstasy. On Wednesday morning, I sat still in entire resignedness to God and willingness that God should bless his Buell's labors here as much as he pleased. I rejoiced when I saw the honor which God put upon him and the respect paid him by the people and the greater success attending his preaching than had followed the preaching of Mr. Edwards. She tried to persuade herself that she really believed this when she went in the afternoon at 3 o'clock to a lecture preached by Buell. We remained in the meeting house about 3 hours after the public exercises were over. During most of the time, my bodily strength was overcome, and the joy and thankfulness which were excited in my mind led me to converse with those who were near me in a very earnest manner. After this jag of compulsive talking, Sarah came home to find Buell there, talking with 5 guests. Including her next-door neighbor, Eleanor DeWitt. She was later to marry General Lyman, a Revolutionary War hero. She relates that the intenseness of my feelings again took away my bodily strength. I could with difficulty refrain from rising from my seat and leaping for joy. The next day she went on managing the household, burped babies, planned food for the extra house guests, supervised snow shoveling, but she engaged in the duties of my family with a sweet consciousness that God was present with me. About 11 o'clock that morning she accidentally went into one room where Buell was talking with somebody, and she quietly fainted. Buell applied a peculiar first aid procedure. He read aloud a hymn of Isaac Watts, which made so strong an impression on my mind, and my soul was drawn so powerfully towards Christ and heaven that I leaped unconsciously from my chair. With that, Sarah fainted again, and the concerned guests put her in bed, where she lay for a considerable time, faint with joy. By this time, the whole town was buzzing. Mrs. Samuel Phelps openly worried that Sarah would die before Edwards returned, and he should think the people had killed his wife. What young Mr. Buell thought would be interesting to know, the neighbors took turns holding the household together while Sarah lay on the bed from 12 o'clock till 4, being too exhausted by joy to rise and sit up, and during most of the time my feelings prompted me to converse very earnestly with one and another of those who were present. Enthusiasm is an 18th century word which was used in the sense that a person was ridiculous to the verge of insanity in his religious zeal. Dr. Johnson defined it as vain confidence of divine favor or communication. The mildest description of the day Sarah spent then would be enthusiastic. The subject of sainthood is still mysterious. Some modern observers think that all religious extremes are pathological. Back in 1902, the Harvard psychologist William James, asked to deliver the Gifford Lectures in Edinburgh, examined the varieties of religious experience. James's method of separating true religious experience from insanity he called pragmatism, the objective scrutiny of, 1, a phenomena, and 2, its result. James analyzed the reports about many people who were considered saints and isolated 3 factors that were present in all the stories. First, the subject went through a term of restlessness, of anguished wrestling. Then came a crisis, a vision. The aftermath was joy, peace, freedom, a transition from tenseness, self-responsibility, and worry to equanimity, receptivity, and peace. James's words precisely describe the steps through which Sarah was to pass, and her case is a large portion of James's chapter entitled Saintliness. What happened to Sarah Edwards during that snowy week of January 1742, her husband believed to be a theological crisis, part of the process of her conversion, the gate through which she had to stumble before she could share the full sweetness in the university that God rules. An observer dyed in the views of Freud and his followers could come up with a psychological explanation for the week. William James confessed that he knew no logical explanation for such shiftings of inner equilibrium. He simply says, "The further limits of our being plunge, it seems to me, into an altogether other dimension of existence from the sensible and merely understandable world." However one may choose to interpret this part of her story, there is no doubt whatever that afterwards Sarah Edwards emerged a changed and liberated person, one whom even her husband, previously her only critic, was to consider a saint. It was a week of emotional crises, but its aftermath was a new life grounded on practical reality. Meanwhile, God worked on Sarah in his mysterious way. On January 29, she woke up trembling with an anxiety about the fact that Mr. Williams of Hadley was scheduled to speak in Northampton that day. She made herself examine my heart, whether I was willing that he should be made a greater instrument of good in the town than Mr. Edwards. I never felt such an entire emptiness of self-love or any regard to any private, selfish interest of my own. It seemed to me that I had entirely done with myself. I felt that the opinions of the world concerning me were nothing. So she pulled herself together and managed to attend the meeting. Afterward, she talked feverishly with the people near her. She went home, tried to read a bit in the Bible, and fainted again. For the next 2 days, she was in a transport, which some would define as a hallucination. She imagined that she was experiencing a rhapsodic vision. I thought if I were surrounded by enemies who were venting their malice and cruelty upon me, it would still be impossible that I should cherish any feelings toward them but those of love and pity. Then her other anxiety surfaced as she thought about her relationship with Edwards, but she concluded that if the feelings and conduct of my husband were to be changed from tenderness and affection to extreme hatred and cruelty, I could so rest in God that it would not touch my heart. The bogey of the feud with Mr. Williams still pursued her. Just then Mr. W. came in and spoke with a somewhat light, smiling air of the flourishing state of religion in the town, which I could scarcely bear to see. Her reply to him was to faint again. The next day, she sat at the dinner table with her large household and had one more spell of fainting while Mr. Buell was holding forth to the group. But the following day, a parishioner, Mr. Lyman, who had been on an errand in Boston, stopped by to say that he had come through Leicester on the way back. He brought cheerful news about the success Edwards was having there. This braced Sarah, though she had spent a sleepless night on a purely imaginary problem. How should I feel if our house and all our property should be burnt up? She was not the first or last woman to lose a night of rest on some such borrowed trouble. Then Edwards returned. This may have been an electric confrontation. It is instructive to note the matters on which a very articulate man chooses to be silent. Edwards wrote torrentially, but he was reticent about his own role in relation to his wife here. Perhaps he felt a measure of responsibility for her slide into unreality, for the incident which had unglued her was the time that she imagined she had irritated Edwards. I found that it seemed to bereave me of the quietness and calm of my mind in any respect not to have the good opinion of my husband. There may have been forgiveness to ask and give on both sides, and then there may have been, in a deep sense, reunion. Next, Edwards did an amazing thing. His ability to forecast future developments was both his genius and his burden. Long before anyone had thought of psychotherapy, he anticipated it. He had Sarah sit down and tell him everything she could remember about the weeks just past. Using the shorthand system he had invented, he took down her words in full. By promptly reliving the strange weeks she had just spent, Sarah seems to have discharged the pressures of 14 taut years. From then on, she sailed through strains that would have sent another woman into bitter seclusion or into whining invalidism with migraines or sinus. So she went back to making jams and hemming linens. But after this time, her work appears to have been done without resentment.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L 3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. and remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."